Excuse me. There's a yawn burp happening. Give me one moment.
A yerp. Or a bon.
No, it's neither of those. It's a yawn burp. Some things can't be portmanteaued, okay?
I just did. I just portmanteaued them.
Badly. All right? A portmanteau, like any word, this is a conversation I have to have with my five-year-old all the time, Jamie. which is that, like, what is the virtue of language? It is to be understood, to communicate and to be understood. Your portmanteau is shit if I have to ask you what it means.
I feel like yerp is pretty self-explanatory.
Yerp? Really? Yerp?
Shut up, Scott. Let's move on. Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about wine and movies.
God damn it, Jamie. he always finds a new way to antagonize me, and this is like the old way.
This is a very old way of antagonizing you.
Well, anyway, welcome, everyone, to this particular podcast that we are here recording from the virtual bunker once again.
Once again, and for those of you who don't know shit about one or both of those topics, that's wine or movies, I'm Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
He's Jamie. He's the wine guy. I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. We are here to help you, dearest audience. Now, normally, each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that Jamie loves.
And normally, we tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Sometimes we don't. Today, and for the next few weeks, we will be doing something a little different. This is part two of our mini-series, Pinot Grigio versus the M4 Tricks. Or, it's so easy to forget how much Pinot Grigio the Matrix pumps into your head until you unplug.
I like that one. That's a good line, and that's yet another fun, tortured way to cram Pinot Grigio into a line from this movie that so far I don't think a lot of people find particularly quotable. But I do. A lot of it's just burned into my brain, having watched it four times now, of course.
Yep. Five for me.
Yeah. But yeah, so this is the second episode in our bizarre, convoluted journey, making parallels between Jamie's beloved Pinot Grigio and both of our beloved The Matrix Resurrections.
Today, we'll be diving into Scarbolo's Il Ramato Pinot Grigio, which if you haven't tasted it, it's available at b-21.com for 18 United States dollars.
Well, for my side of the things, we're getting hyper granular today, and I want to drill down and just talk about the first 12 minutes of the movie, the sequence that we'll refer to as the modal prologue, the opening sequence that I think is doing so much, so very, very, very quickly that on my first viewing, I was delightfully bewildered, and I needed another viewing or two just to unpack like everything that is happening and being built upon and all the layers that are happening in this first 12 minutes that, you know, all of that sounds like super pretentious and academic and boring, but like, it's also a thrilling and delightful sequence. So we're digging in. We're talking about the modal today.
But we should start with the wine, right?
I mean, I guess we do have to talk about the wine. Fine. Talk about the wine, Jamie. This is an orange wine.
This lives in a weird area between like white wine, rosé, and orange wine.
That sounds like your address.
Yes, that's correct. I am at the intersection of White Wine Boulevard, Rosé Avenue, and Orange Wine, I don't know, Parkway.
This is our first orange wine on the show, right?
Yes, it is.
I did not know until you said off mic that this was orange wine, that this was orange. I just thought it was, I don't know. I guess I didn't think too hard about the color. Like you said, Pinot Grigio, but it looks kind of like a rosé. And so it's an orange wine. How much orange juice goes into the making of this wine?
It's a very funny joke, Scott.
Isn't that how it gets to be orange? Is they add delicious sun-kissed orange juice to it?
Yes, specifically Valencia oranges.
Is it from concentrate?
They add a particular...
Gotta bleep that.
Yes, you do. Yeah. So for those of you out there who don't know what orange wine is white wine that is made like red wine. So we've talked a little bit about how red wine gets its color from macerating with its skins. If you just macerate white grape juice with its skins, you get a certain amount of color and texture from those skins. Ramato is a play on the word rame, which is Italian for copper. And that I think is appropriate for the color of this particular wine. But let's back it up a second.
Mm-hmm.
Just a moment. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Pinot Gris, and I don't think we've mentioned yet that Pinot Gris is technically the same variety as Pinot Noir.
I don't understand.
I know.
Is this like a genetic thing?
Yeah. So Pinot Gris or Grigio, those are just synonyms, is just a color mutation of Pinot Noir. It's called really just Pinot. So you've got Pinot Noir, Pinot Grigio, Pinot Blanc, and they're just color mutations of one another.
But they don't all taste the same.
They do not.
Like, I mean, I know like the finished product doesn't taste the same, but like on the vine, like if I was grabbing a fistful off the vine of Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, and Pinot Gris, they would all taste different.
They would taste somewhat different. And it would depend on like if you're in a vineyard that's interplanted, let's say, with all three of these varieties, they would taste remarkably similar right off the vine because they are essentially the same variety. And I'm here to tell you, from a warmer, more ripe climate, Pinot Grigio is very difficult to distinguish cosmetically from Pinot Noir. Grigio means gray, so it's a lighter color mutation of Pinot Noir, but it's not a white grape. We think of Pinot Grigio as a white grape because it is mostly made into white wine, but you can, as I've said, also make white wine from Pinot Noir.
By getting the skins off first, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yep. It's got just white juice.
White juice.
That's right.
That should be your rap name, Jamie.
It absolutely should not be anyone's rap name.
I don't know. I feel like somebody could pull it off.
Maybe someone could pull it off.
Yeah. But then I would be skeptical of their politics.
And you would be right to be skeptical of those politics.
I'm skeptical of everyone's politics. Can I share my notes with you on this wine?
Yes. Yes, you can.
So I opened this, the Scarbolo and the Chauffite last night because we're doing a double recording session today. And I thought something was wrong. My first thought that I said to Tani was like, are these the same grape? Is this actually the same type of wine? this one kind of reminded me of, and this I could be totally off base here. It kind of reminded me of the Loimer, the Gruner Veltliner that we did with Shaun of the Dead.
Interesting.
I don't know. I had a rare like sense memory association between this and another wine, which is like a quantum leap for me in, you know, taste memory. But I think it was the Loimer, but I'm not certain.
There are a lot of similarities between Pinot Gris and Gruner Veltliner. And I'm here to tell you, like, in a blind tasting scenario, if I'm, you know, going down a path and I have a white wine that's relatively neutral that is presenting lesy, I'm going to be thinking both Gruner and Pinot Gris, and I'm going to be trying to drill down on which one based on some really granular points of information.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is you did good, Scotty.
Yeah. Okay, good. So you brought it back around to making sure that you recognize that I was correct about this. Great.
Yes.
Good. Okay.
I'm proud of you.
Good. Thank you. You should be. I drank two glasses of wine last night. You should be proud of me.
I'm very, very proud.
From two different bottles.
I drank a bottle of wine last night.
You drank a bottle of wine this morning when you got out of bed.
That is not true. I drank a bottle of wine last night and then I went to bed and then I woke morning. Up and showered and had breakfast and coffee and then started talking to your bitch ass.
So anyway, I have notes. I have thoughts. So the orange of it all is throwing me off just on the look of it. But it, so you said copper. Copper is what I noted on my little tasting notes journal here.
Yeah.
So the hue is copper. Is this deep? Would we say this is a deep coppery color or is this more like a medium?
Medium, I'd say. But like you're splitting hairs. I wouldn't worry too much about that specifically. Like this is a copper color. It's pretty through and through and there's no like variation.
I hope you didn't infer from my tone of voice that I was worried about being wrong about that. I'm not going to lose any sleep over getting any of the wine details wrong here, buddy.
Scott, I know that you just live to impress me with your wine tasting abilities.
Mm. So on the nose, the schnuffer, super fragrant. Like I opened the bottle and immediately got a blast of honey and brown sugar and like a bag of raisins. I was getting like really, really strong, sweet smells right off the bat.
Cool.
And then for the flavor notes, strawberries. Is it kiwi? There's like a kiwi thing maybe?
Yeah, I get a little bit of a tropical situation going on here. Maybe kiwi, maybe guava.
I couldn't say from guava, but I think kiwi. I was drinking this as Tani opened a box that she got from, I think it's called Miami Fruit. This like rare exotic fruit seller that like ships stuff to her. And she just got like their sample box for the month or for the quarter or whatever. And she was just going through delighted all the weird fruits that came in. Kiwi was not one of them, but I don't know. Maybe that put me in the mindset. But I think kiwi, getting honey notes and some kind of citrus. I can't place it, but some kind of citrus in the ballpark. And it's very bright. Is bright an accurate description for this wine?
Yeah, I would say that this wine is bright for sure. The only thing that I would add to your aroma notes would be like some kind of a red fruit. I think this is a little bit reminiscent of like, have you ever had the like the real cranberry juice, the like bitter tart stuff?
The stuff that's gross?
Yes.
Yes, I've had the stuff that's gross.
This is like that.
Mm. Yeah, I guess, yeah, there's definitely a tartness to it. Again, suggestible now that you say it. I'm like, oh yes, of course there's a tartness that I'm detecting on the palate here. and so, all right, so body, this is medium, right? This is not super viscous.
Yeah, medium body.
Tannin and astringencies, I got nothing. I can't tell. What is this?
It's pretty low.
Yeah.
You know, I with this color, you would expect a little bit more, but knowing as I do that this only spends 24 hours with its skins, you know, it's not getting a ton of astringency.
Hmm. And acidity is medium minus, maybe? Is it not very high acid?
I would go medium. I think it's just straight medium.
Alcohol, I didn't even check. What does the bottle say on the alcohol? This is 13%.
Yeah.
13% medium alcohol. And dry minus? It's not it's bone dry.
The wine's dry, not bone dry. Correct.
So anyway, those are my thoughts on this wine. I like it. I think I like it. The other one that we'll talk about in next week, the Chauffeur, I found utterly mystifying. And then I opened this one second and I think I like this one. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. I like this one a lot. This is just tasty. This is the kind of wine that you could open up by the poolside and not really think too much about it. This is the kind of wine that would be great as an entry wine at a party. It would be good just with charcuterie and cheese. I think it's just kind of vibrant and easygoing. It allows deep thought, but doesn't require it.
What do you mean an entry wine at a party?
The kind of wine that like it as you arrive at a party, someone puts a glass in your hand.
Well, no, I understand that, but why? Why is this good for an entry wine as compared to something else?
When you think about an entry wine, you want to be able to just trust that someone's going to enjoy it and not worry about like personal preference too much. And there's nothing I don't think offensive about this wine. It's just super easy and anybody would be like, yeah, I'll have a half a glass or a whole glass of this and then I'll figure out what to do next.
And then, so what, not that I want to go down this rabbit hole too deep, but then what do we follow that up with? So like this is your entry wine and then what do you get like for your drunken bacchanals that you like to throw? Like you're going to do, I don't know, 9 more bottles for people. Like do they get progressively weirder and more difficult or?
Yeah, they get progressively more serious. They get progressively or they like once you reach a point of seriousness and drunkenness, where when those two points converge.
Yeah, that's when you crack out the MGD, right?
We prefer high life, Scott.
Right. You prefer high life. The champagne of beers. I know, Jamie. I know all of your basic beer takes. I'm familiar.
Although I've been very much on the Budweiser kick lately.
That is just so surprising to me. It is.
I would love to one day go to the Anheuser-Busch brewery with you. Just so that you could see the fucking massive scale of that operation.
I've seen it, Jamie. I've seen it. I saw those fucking J.J. Abrams Star Trek movies. That's what J.J. thinks the fucking warp core of the Enterprise looks like is a beer fucking brewery.
Which, I mean, honestly, it kind of looks like that in there.
No, it doesn't. It looks like a bunch of stainless steel tanks with pipes and tubes. The Enterprise is not run on stainless steel tanks and pipes and whatever.
Why
it's
not?
Fine. But it's fine. I'm going to complain enough about that man and those movies in our next episode. I don't want to do it right now. I don't want to do it.
Okay, let's talk more about this wine.
You're not allowed to make Star Trek about a fucking 9/11 false flag conspiracy, okay? All right? It's offensive. It's offensive.
I'm not allowed or JJ's not allowed?
No one is allowed. You don't do that okay. With Star Trek. It is inappropriate. Gene Roddenberry, crazy man that he was, is rolling in his grave.
Duly noted. Scotty's take has been recorded, and anyone who has problems should DM him.
All right. So tell me, why are we talking about this? What about this wine gets your toes a tapping?
Well, so let's start with some of the things that I told you about it that led you to talk about, well, the Matrix Resurrections generally, and then the modal more specifically, mm-hmm. and I'll drill down on each of those aspects.
Sure.
The originator of this estate, whose name is Gino, came from generations of tenant farmers, which could also be described as sharecroppers, though sharecropping is kind of a weighted phrase here in the United States.
Yeah, there's some baggage with sharecroppers. Although I will say, Jamie, speaking of baggage, you speak tenant, T-E-N-A-N-T, not tenant. I'm Martin Donovan, crisscrossing my fingers together as I say the word tenant as a secret signal to let you know that I'm part of the future versus past, past versus future time inversion war.
Yes, correct. Right. Tenant.
You're not tenant. Farming for inverted bullets. The tenant, no, someone who lives on someone else's land and pays rent.
Oh my God. So you just said farming for inverted bullets, and I went back to Mad Max Fury Road.
Because
and
of the
what about
farmer.
The inverted bullet farmer?
Oh shit. I mean, maybe that's what it is. Maybe the bullet farmer is the one who starts the time war because who destroyed the world? It was us in the present day. Maybe Tenet is a secret sequel to Fury Road. Internet fan theories. What? Let's make a YouTube channel and we'll get millions of views.
No, it can't be that because one of those movies is good and the other one is Tenet.
I mean, I think Tenet transcends good, but no, I don't think that. Let's move on. Let's move on. Let's try and do one episode where we don't argue about Tenet. I apologize. Please continue. Tenet farmers, not sharecroppers.
That's correct. Tenant farmers. So they are sharecroppers in the like specific definition of that word, meaning that they don't own the land. They owe a portion of their crop to the owners. The situation wasn't as punitive for Gino and his family as it was for those maligned people in the United States.
Right.
less than a century ago.
It didn't come about as a result of, oh shit, we lost slavery. Let's Jim Crow these poor people into still being indentured servants.
Correct.
Okay.
Still not a great situation, but Gino and family were able to purchase their way out and buy some land in Friuli on the valley floor. We'll get into the difference between valley floor and hilltops, but for right now, just suffice it to say the valley floor land was less expensive and it allowed them to get their foot in the door for winemaking. And because they were in the area they were in, they decided to hang their hats on the Pinot Grigio grape, partly because that was what was widely planted when they purchased in the middle of the 20th century, but also partly because they did it sort of right around the time of the Santa Margarita craze.
The Santa Margarita craze.
That's right. I've invoked Santa Margarita a couple of times on this podcast before, and I have, yes.
And okay, well, I clearly don't remember. What is that? And why does it sound like, I don't know, some kind of strain of syphilis that went through a cruise line?
That was a high wire act there, Scotty. It was
very specific.
It really was. So Santa Margarita is a brand of Pinot Grigio that comes out of northern Italy, a little bit to the north and west of Friuli. And it is still currently today what is considered the dominant style of Pinot Grigio, a really clean, very neutral white wine that we've discussed is very much associated with white women.
Right.
And drinking in excess.
Right. Unfairly and stereotypically associated with them.
Yes. They took this grape and decided to use the modern techniques that had been pioneered by Mario Schioppetto and apply them to the older style of winemaking, which is the Ramato method, allowing the grapes to sit with their skins and achieve a little bit more texture and aromatic intensity. This is sort of the confluence of those two forces at the same time. So you're using tradition, this Ramato style, which originated in the 19th century, combining it with modern technique to create this wine, which I think is really brilliantly clean and easy drinking, as I've mentioned.
I'm sorry. Can you remind me what does clean mean in a wine?
Free of flaw. In my estimation, anyway, there is currently a lot of baggage around the word clean in wine, mostly due to Cameron Diaz.
What?
She launched a wine brand called, I think it's Evangeline.
Okay.
And is marketing it as clean wine, which she estimates to mean low additive, which is great, except she's spectacularly untransparent with the sourcing of grapes and whatever goes into it.
So you don't actually know if there's low additives. You don't even know what's in the wine.
Correct.
Cameron, come on, come back to the movies, unretire. We miss you. Leave this wine nonsense behind.
It's really very silly. So when I use the word clean, what I mean is it's presenting free of flaw. There is no volatile acidity or Brettanomyces or mousiness or oxidation. The wine is well made, thoughtfully made.
Well, hang on. Because we've talked about clean a bunch before, and the Brettanomyces and the other things and the flaws. This is all coming back to me. This is familiar. Mousiness feels like a new vocabulary word and an extremely unappealing one, Jamie.
Yep.
What is mousiness in a wine?
Mousiness is a... We really don't have to go into mousiness right now.
Well, but you use interesting and fun words that make my stomach turn, like I need to know. So is it is it mousiness like how one might, you know, pejoratively describe a librarian? Or is it mousiness like the presence of small rodents in the bottle?
It's not the presence of small rodents in the bottle, but it is it's a flaw that presents not on the nose, specifically on the palate, and can present in... This is going to really gross you out, and it grosses me out too.
Okay.
But the texture of the wines can end up feeling a little bit fuzzy.
Ew.
Yeah, it's gross. It's not good. Don't like it.
Don't you ever serve me a mousy wine, Jamie. I want no part of fuzzy wine.
I try to avoid mousy wines at all costs.
All right, so this is not one of those things that sounds gross to me, but that there's some people who really like it. No one likes mousy wines.
No, there are people who like mousy wine.
Jamie, no one in the world of wine likes mousy wines. Just tell me this so I can go on with my day.
I would be lying to you, Scott, if I told you that no one in the world of wine liked mousy wine.
Jamie, lie to me. Just make me feel better. I don't mind being lied to as long as it hides these ugly truths about your disgusting wine world from me.
I don't know if you caught earlier this week, I had a little bit of an Instagram rant in my stories about someone asking for flawed wine at my bar.
I did see that.
Yeah, this person wanted mousy wine. This person wanted mousy wine with volatile acidity and Brettanomyces. They wanted a wine that was fucked up, in my opinion. And I don't serve fucked up wine.
How did you resolve this situation? Did you give them fucked up wine?
I don't have fucked up wine to give them. So we found one that was amenable. And she sipped on that for the remainder of the evening.
Jamie, the customer is always right. You gotta take care of these people. The customer is always right, Jamie.
I actually wrote an article about how they're not.
I'm baiting you. It's okay. It's all right. I'm Tom Hardy wagging my finger at you. That's bait, Jamie. You just bit down on that one. All right, fine. Enough of mousiness.
Usually take the bait.
Yeah. Mousiness. Ugh. Mousiness. Yeah, that's bait. That was bait. And you knew I was going to take it too. And I fucking played into your hand.
It's true. I did say that specifically to make you upset.
You son of a bitch.
So yeah, this wine is clean. It's delightful. It's easy drinking, and we don't have to worry about like the volatile esters and contamination that sometimes for me are hallmarks of orange wine. And this is where we come to a quick moment where I gripe about orange wine, because it's become this like area where fucked up wine is okay. Even more so than in like other sectors of the natty wine world. Like we expect orange wine to be super acidic and be basically vinegar. And that most of the time I don't like it.
Yeah, I wouldn't want anything that tastes like vinegar either. Why is that prevalent in orange wine?
because you have careless winemakers, because it's become a hallmark of the style and it's become kind of expected that orange wines are fucked up in that way. Partly because some of the like really classic producers do make wines that are very volatile, but it's balanced out by a fuller body or textural intrigue to a degree that the wine is interesting. And while it's flawed, it's not undrinkable. And that has led to other winemakers just making wine that, in my opinion, is undrinkable.
And mousy.
And frequently mousy.
Mm. All right. Well, then I concur with you that this orange wine situation sounds untenable. I do not approve. Leave the fuzz out of it, y'all.
Leave the fuzz out of it. We don't like it. So I mentioned earlier that these vines are planted on the valley floor in Friuli.
As compared to on the hilltops.
Correct.
What does that do? Why is that good?
Well, we've talked a little bit about marginal land being the place where grapes grow best, right?
Right, because hang on, let me see if I recall this, Jamie, because this is a test for me and my retention.
Yes.
So they use the marginal land because it's the only land that's available because the priority is food and we got to grow food. And so we use the best soil to feed people. That's just reasonable because we live in a society, or at least we want to. I think I'm accidentally quoting a Joker meme, which I'm not happy about. Anyway, but so they've also found that the struggle that the marginal land creates for the vine leads to better juice, right?
That's correct.
See? I listen when you talk.
Sometimes you do. And well, I appreciate it when you do.
I listen to you talking when I'm editing the show and then hearing it over and over and over again. That's when it sinks in. Repetition, Jamie. Repetition.
Exactly. Helps. No, I for sure know it. So yeah, typically hilltops are that marginal land. You know, valley floor tends to be very fertile areas for growing food.
Because of like drainage and just gravity, the water and the nutrients come down. Is that the idea?
The nutrients specifically. And then also you're closer to the water table. Correct. So these vines, though, are planted in an area where you might expect higher vigor and higher yields. And that's part of the thing where we talked about struggle creating better wine. The lower the yields are, the more concentrated the fruit is, right?
Right. More flavor, less grape.
Correct. But when you're making orange wine or Ramato wine, you're already adding something to it by allowing it to macerate with the skins. So getting a little bit higher yield, getting a little bit of extra juice, then being able to macerate into that can give you a style like this that is very friendly and easygoing, as opposed to something which may come from the hilltops that would be kind of sharp and austere.
So your thing about the valley floor and it being what you said as an uncommon perspective, I immediately, because I know you well and I know your, you know, soapboxes, I took that like from like a political or like class struggle thing, you know, the valley floor, people on the bottom versus people on the top. That's not what you're going for. This is literally about like topography.
It's literally about topography, but if you want to go into the politics and the economics of it, having more fruit from your vines on the valley floor allows you to make more wine per acre, which then allows you to have more wine to sell. And it also allows you to sell this particular wine at $18 a bottle as opposed to, let's say, $28 a bottle.
Well, I'm definitely in favor of that. Is the valley floor land, would that not also be more expensive, right? Like that's easier land and better land that you could grow food product on.
It depends on the place.
Okay.
And here we run into an area that is very hilly, and it's less about like one large valley like the Napa or the Sonoma valleys and more about smaller valleys in between rolling hills. So it's not like a giant area of land that can be cultivated en masse for food, which is why these sort of smaller areas are available for winemakers.
Hmm. Fascinating. I'm going to pour myself another glass.
Yeah, I really dig this wine. I'm liking it even more now than when I tasted it a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, it's mega nums. Is this like super accessible, or like, do you think I could find this in a state store?
I don't know about the state, to be totally honest with you. It certainly, they make enough of it that it could be sold to the state, but I'm not sure about that. But it is widely available. This is not a difficult bottle to find. And they make a number of other bottlings. Like they make a wine called Ramato XL, which is it gets macerated on the skins for a couple of weeks rather than 24 hours. And then it gets oak aged. So it's a whole other perspective on Ramato, something more intense, fuller, and perhaps a little bit more thought provoking.
For our like roughly 20% of our audience who are in the greater Philadelphia area, I'm looking on the Pennsylvania Fine Wine and Good Spirits, the PLCB store's website, and they have the Scarbolo Friuli Pinot Grigio. What is the big difference between the Friuli and the Il Ramato?
The Friuli would be done in the same way that the Schioppetto that we had last week was done, just direct press off the skins. It's a white wine.
All right. And we don't get all the orange.
Correct. And I think that's what's interesting about what this winery does. Economically, of course, they need to make a white wine that pays the bills, that keeps the lights on. But this is more what they're going for. They also make a really cool wine called My Time. That's a blend of Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Grigio. It gives you like, I don't know. It's one of these like singular white wines that really could only come out of Italy, that has intense aromatics and broad texture. And it kind of doesn't make sense between your nose and your palate. You just know that you're enjoying yourself. I've loved that wine for a long, long time.
So Jamie, it feels like you've actually like done the work and, you know, created a narrative. You've already tied this one back into the Schioppetto that we drank last week. So how does this fit into your narrative of Pinot Grigio?
You know, I think the part of the impetus for this mini series is me bucking against a narrative that I see in the wine world, which is a thing that you razz me for a bunch.
Well, it's your favorite thing in the world to do because you are a self-styled iconoclast.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And that narrative being the Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio, the Ecco Domani, the neutral, gluggable white wine that is basically nothing but a vessel to get drunk. Pinot Grigio can be so many things. And we saw the Schioppetto and what that was and how it expressed itself. And I talked a little bit last time about how that modern technique then got applied to the Santa Margaritas and Ecco Domanis of the world to make them even more neutral.
I do recall this, yes.
And so here we're synthesizing that modern technique, that cleanliness in the winery, the stainless steel tanks, with a look back at a more traditional style, the Ramato style, as a way of making this copper-hued wine that is something a little bit more than either of those styles, right? It's not neutral in the way that Santa Margherita is, and it's not funky and flawed in the way that other orange wines can be. It's pleasant and easy drinking and lovely.
Can you compare this wine to the Schioppetto, which I have very little recollection of, which has more to do with me than it does with that wine? But like, for let's say anybody is playing along at home and they've got the bottles, you know, and they're tasting week to week, like how do you compare the flavor and the profile and the whatever, the nose of this to that wine?
They're pretty incredibly different wines. You know, I mentioned the fresh, bitter cranberry character of this wine. It's completely absent from the Schioppetto. The Schioppetto has a sharper bitterness to it. I would say that the Schioppetto is more of a gastronomic wine, one that would be ideally served with dinner. And this would be closer to a cocktail wine, as I mentioned, sort of a party entrance wine. But specific flavor comparisons, I think that the Schioppetto was fuller in body. As I said, it had that bitterness. It has a much more pronounced citrus character to it. And it's also showing botrytis. We talked a little bit about the sort of like honeysuckle, honey, ginger notes in that wine. that give it sort of this round presentation, those are kind of absent from this wine. This wine is just the fruit, a little bit of skin contact, easy peasy.
Yeah, I need to put this glass down because we have the whole rest of this recording to get through and then a whole nother episode after that. And I have to drink for that one as well. Yeah, I'm grooving on this one, man. I'm going to try and, I guess, track more of this down.
I like it too. I'm glad. All right, Scott. So we talked about this wine and my thoughts about this wine.
And my thoughts.
And your thoughts, your very, very useful, helpful thoughts.
I was both astute and erudite, I think. I'm pretty sure.
Sure. Let's go with that.
Yeah, let's go with those words.
So given all of the things that we've said about this wine, why have you deigned to discuss simply the first 12 minutes of this movie?
Well, this is a multi-pronged answer, as most of my answers to literally any question will be.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, I know. Because the first 12 minutes of this movie are fucking awesome, and it's a great excuse to talk about them. Second, because when we were putting together this miniseries, I had gone down like a deep rabbit hole on Matrix Resurrections, and anything anyone said to me made me think about bugs or the analyst or anything from the movie, and I was already primed to be thinking about it. But also just like a lot of the shit that you are talking about this wine makes me think about the modal. But before I want to get into all of that, I feel like for the audience's sake, we don't normally do like deep plot breakdowns on the show. But since we're talking about one sequence, a sequence that I think, and you probably would agree, I would hope, that is like very, very dense and super important to the movie, but that its importance and its significance and its meaning is kind of not really revealed until much later in the film.
You're like on the edge of your seat trying to figure this thing out for 12 minutes, and then it ends and you're like, okay, I still don't get it. What happened?
Yeah. But so I think there's value in just like as quickly as I can going through what actually happens in the modal. And I want to just talk about that first to kind of orient the audience and kind of lay the groundwork for the conversation that we're about to have.
All right, Scotty, as quickly as you can.
As quickly as I can.
Briefly.
All right, deep breath. Woosah. Okay, so the movie, the modal sequence, opens with, as any Matrix movie does, with the falling green code. And then the title comes up and the sounds and the images and the title and the music is exactly like all three of the original movies in the Matrix trilogy from 99 to 2003. Then we've got more code on screen. We see like a command prompt talking about a modal, whatever that is. And we have voiceover from characters that we will learn are Bugs and Seek or Sequoia. And they're talking about, what is this? This is a trap. Are you going to enter the modal? And it's very much just like Trinity and Cypher in the 99 movie talking about Morpheus wants to watch him. And it's already grounding us in like we're doing the same thing again. Then your very first shot of the movie, which I'll talk about in a later episode, but we start with the SWAT team coming in to find our fake Trinity. And so we're continuing this restaging of the first movie. Outside, we've got the agents arriving. We see a very provocative image of a black agent, a character played by Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, who we will learn is the new Morpheus in the Smith role, doing all of the Smith dialogue with the cop. No, Lieutenant, your men are already dead. Then we cut back in, and now we're with Bugs, played by Jessica Henwick, and she is watching like from the like through the walls, essentially. She's watching this recreation of the Trinity opening. She says, like, we know what's about to happen. Seek says, why are we using old code to create something new? Like, now we have basically like a fan perspective watching this recreation of the opening of the first film. The scene proceeds. Morpheus 2 spots Bugs. He chases her down. He finds her hiding in a key shop. He grabs her and he drags her through what looks exactly like the Keymaker's corridor that is a big part of Matrix Reloaded. Through that corridor of doorways into a recreation of Thomas Anderson, Neo, his apartment from the first movie. Morpheus reveals himself to her. He says, I am Morpheus and my purpose is to find Neo. She hugs him, this like very empathetic moment. She hugs him. She gives him the red pill. There's some very silly slapstick, which kind of is a way to like let the audience know like, hey, this is not going to be so serious. We're going to be okay getting goofy here with this movie. And then the two of them escape the pursuing agents by jumping out a window and falling through a skylight into that iconic falling green code. And the camera zooms out. And now we're on a window like a desktop on Thomas's computer. And we see a minimized window displaying that classic green Matrix code. Did I leave anything out particularly pertinent?
I think you got it, except like The slapstick bits are obviously some of my favorite bits.
I think it's great. I've never worn different sunglasses before.
And when he sees the other agents and just laughs.
Yeah, he's like, he's drunk.
Oh, the one thing that you did miss is the quick line of dialogue where we establish that Morpheus 2 / Smith is actually a program,
right,
and that programs can be liberated in the same way that people can.
Right. He is a digital sentience.
His reveal is that, like, his purpose is to destroy sentience, which is a word that we're now, like, first introduced to in this sequence.
No, he says he's sentience. Sentient doesn't come in until later.
I could swear he says sentient.
She describes him. She says, are you aware that you are a digital sentience? And he says, yes. And I know that my purpose is to, or I know that my function is to track down and destroy sentience like you.
Okay.
Sentient comes in later. And that's for the machines that have liberated and removed themselves.
I misunderstood. I thought that he was, in my multiple viewings, I thought that he was saying sentience at that point. And I was like, that's interesting.
Yeah. I have broken my own rule and I've turned on the subtitles a few times with this movie just because there is a lot of very dense and quickly delivered, like, you know, like terminology and vocabulary, right, that I wanted to be very clear about.
Anyway, we establish that he is a program. Yeah, he's not a human being who's plugged into the Matrix, but even programs can be given the red pill.
Right, exactly.
And the red pill means something relatively similar for programs that it does for people. This also is where we establish that we don't need hardline phones anymore.
I think we establish that later. I think on multiple viewings, it becomes clear. But like the first time, you just see them fall through the glass and then the code starts falling. You don't know that they've jacked out, that they've escaped from the Matrix or the modal.
It seemed clear to me even on my first viewing that falling through that portal, you know, that Seek was guiding them there.
Yeah.
It was obvious that he was guiding, like, he's the operator. He's guiding them to an exit.
Interesting.
And the exit was this portal. Hmm. That for me was clear.
Okay.
I can understand that it might not be for everyone else. Yeah.
Well, this is like part of why I wanted to talk about it, because it's just so goddamn dense. Like, we've talked about this before. I watched the movie twice in a day. And the second time I watched it, I was like, oh, I get it. Like, I really see what you're doing here, because all the pieces that are trickled out throughout the rest of the movie suddenly help you lock in what this 12 minutes is talking about. But so over the next act, like, we will later learn about the modal that Thomas Anderson, a video game designer played by Keanu Reeves, has created this modal as a secret side project at his video game design company called Deus Machina. And the project is using old code that looks to the audience exactly like original Matrix code. And Morpheus 2, this digital sentience, this program, was created by Thomas, and he was dropped into the role of Smith in this virtual fanfic, which I kind of think about as like a demo. I was talking with a friend of the show, Ryan, about this, and he brought up, like, we don't know how long the modal goes. Like, does it recreate all of the events of the first movie or the trilogy, or is it just the opening sequence of the first movie with Trinity escaping from the agents? And it, at least for me, with no textual evidence to support it, I just think about it as just what we see, essentially, which is just that opening sequence, kind of like a video game demo.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too.
Yeah. But so what is slowly unspooled is that Thomas did this, created this modal, and put this Morpheus character into it because he is once again suspecting that maybe the events of The Matrix weren't a paranoid schizophrenic fantasy that he based a wildly successful series of video games on, but that they're actually his memories, the events that were depicted in the original three movies, and that Thomas is somehow back in the machine's simulation. He thought that if he was truly back in The Matrix, that only Morpheus, even a program of Morpheus, would be able to free his mind once again. So Bugs and her crew found the modal on Thomas's workstation. She jacks into it like a matrix within the matrix, and she frees Morpheus 2 to join her crew and help them rescue Neo. And all of this takes like quite a bit of time before you actually understand that it happened. What I love is that I imagine that there's like the opening dialogue, that voiceover when we're seeing like the modal like command prompt on the screen, is that I just imagine that if they filmed that scene, it would be Bugs, Jessica Henwick standing at Thomas's workstation in his office, typing away and talking to Seek, and then she just like disappears and pops into his modal mode in the same way that Thomas later imagines himself walking through the modal.
Right.
But yeah, so it's a lot. Just like narratively, it's a lot, and there's a lot of important shit going on in there.
Yeah, it's kind of hard in one viewing to extract everything from that first 12 minutes that is necessary for like an understanding of the rest of the movie.
Yeah, it is very dense, but it's also extremely consequential. You know, like a lot of movies will do this. It's kind of the James Bond model, which is like you always open with a big action sequence that kind of shows the audience this is what to expect for the rest of it. It's going to have stealth and it's going to have intrigue and maybe a woman and there'll be action and vehicles and shit. And that's all largely divorced from the plot that is to come. It's just like it's a cold open.
Right.
And this sequence serves as that, but also as like a visual and thematic and narrative like primer for everything that's going to come. Like this sequence is not divorced from the rest of the movie. It's incredibly important in understanding everything that's going
to
come.
And still manages to be just a blast.
It's so much fun. It's just fucking thrilling. And I think a big part of why it works so well is it's a phenomenal introduction for Bugs, played by Jessica Henwick, who just rules.
So good.
And she's like my favorite character of any movie in 2021. Like, I just love that character so much.
Yeah, I think she's fabulous. I think her performance is great. I think the character on the page also is just a ton of fun. It's hard for me, I think, sometimes to separate the character on the page from the performance.
Yeah.
You know, there's overlap, and I don't know how much, I don't know, direction gets involved in it, but it feels like this character is rich and robust, both on the page and Jessica Henwick's performance elevates it like by another order of magnitude. Her charisma is incredible.
It's like a born movie star performance. She's so watchable and charismatic.
And the way she moves, this is also a good primer on like the way she moves in combat for the rest of the movie, like her general style. Just like her jumping around and like breaking things on her way down and doing Bugs Bunny like jokes when she's backed up to a corner.
Yeah, she's like she's cool as a cucumber, too. What I really like about Bugs and all of her crew, like who are our main characters, our main new characters in the real world, right? Like the replacement for the narrative replacement for the Nebuchadnezzar crew, like Morpheus's crew from the first movies. I feel like they're part of like almost a generational commentary, right? Like they, even though their aesthetic and their look is oftentimes very much in line with the way that the humans, the hackers, the freed people of Zion would present themselves in the Matrix, their residual self-image, a lot of black leather and crazy stylized hair, and everybody wears rad sunglasses all the time. Bugs breaks that a little bit. There's a lot more color in her. There's her blue hair and her like her red parachute pants, and she just has a super rad vibe. They don't have the cool, aloof, like disaffected affect that everybody had in their Matrix avatars in the old movies. Like Bugs is super warm and empathetic. Like Morpheus says, "I am Morpheus," and she immediately gives him this huge hug. She's so warm. She's sympathetic to him. She has her gun trained on him when they have their little Mexican standoff. And she's like, "You understand that you're digital sentience, right?" But she, like, there's this trust that comes out right away. It feels to me very much like it's Lana Wachowski kind of talking about like the younger generation. You know, it's a little bit the way I feel like as an elder millennial. Lana Wachowski is a Gen Xer. But the way that I feel like kind of looking at the Gen Zs, the Zoomers, where like it feels like, to generalize, they're extremely empathetic and warm and very open in their personalities and their identities, you know? And it's just kind of showing us like things have changed in a big way. Like this is your new model for what a freed person looks like in the new real world of the Matrix.
Right. I think exactly that's correct. And I think that, you know, it's expressed in the movie. But in our real world, I think the younger generation just has a better vocabulary for emotions than either us elder millennials or Gen Xers ever got. They're able to identify and describe their emotions better and are more comfortable feeling them out loud, which is exactly as you said, expressed by her just jumping into Morpheus 2's arms, just hugging him.
I love that moment so much. I was so surprised by it when I first saw it. Like, oh, we're just going to trust him right away. And she is right to trust him, you know? It's validated.
And there's only a moment of question from Seek when she gets out of the Keymaster's corridor or whatever. And he catches back up with her and he goes, "But he's an agent." And then immediately, you know, she asks for an exit and he provides and there's no further questions.
Right. Well, it also, like, I love that that sets up that, like, she's a captain, which is another thing. Right. Like, it's a she's a young woman of, like, East Asian, you know, descent. It's a very different look than we've seen in a leadership position in one of these movies before. Everything about Bugs rules. She just owns it. Jessica Henwick rules. And I just want to see so much more of this actress.
Yes. Yeah, same. Very much.
So let me ask you, Jamie, you and I are, let's say, we're not computer illiterate, certainly, but I know fuck all about computer programming. Had you ever heard the term modal before?
Nope.
No. So I talked to a friend of ours, a friend of the show, Ryan. I put him on tape the other day. So give a listen. And Ryan is going to explain to us in terms of, like, computer programming, what a modal really is.
So my name's Ryan. I've been a web application developer for about 10 years now. I've had 10 years of experience in the industry. I have a bachelor's of science in computer science and also a minor in mathematics. When I first saw The Matrix Resurrections, I was wondering that myself what they meant by modal. Because for me, the modals that I deal with are the same ones that everybody sees on the internet in the form of, like, do you want to accept these cookies? You know, do you want to log in? Whenever you see one of those pop-ups in your web browser for logging in, for accepting cookies, anything like that, that's a modal. It's a modal pop-up window. So basically a subordinate portion of the program that you're running that forces you to make a decision, a choice, or do something else before you can really interact with the main portion of the program. So that's what modal means to me with my background. I did look into seeing what a modal meant for a game developer, and I couldn't really find anything else out about that. Yeah, I mean, when I saw that, I just kind of suspected that the modal that Thomas was talking about, it was a code word for a prototype that he was coming up with. Now, when we saw in the movie where Bugs says that we're in a modal, it's a training exercise to New Morpheus, I thought more it was the modal is another code word for, like, a machine learning algorithm. Like, he has fed a new Morpheus in this modal to keep training and keep doing Morpheus-like things so that he can become Morpheus. So I think in a computer science-y way, modal is meaningless in this context. But as a device for the movie, I think it has probably some layers to it that you, the viewer, can kind of go deeper and deeper in looking into and kind of get the definition that you really want to bring out of it that you yourself like.
Yeah. All right. So that was Ryan. Isn't he a good boy?
He's the best boy.
I love him. I'm very fond of him. But yeah, so the reason I wanted to talk to him is because the Matrix movies, the Wachowskis have always used little bits of code or, like, programming concepts to feed into the narratives. Like, the one that always jumps to mind is film critic and host of a podcast that you and I both love, Blank Check with Griven and David. David Sims, who I've said before is a huge defender of the Matrix sequels. One of his big takes is that the Serif fight in Matrix Reloaded, which a lot of people critiqued as, like, being completely superfluous, where Serif challenges Neo to a fight and you to truly know someone, you must fight them. Sims's big take is that the Serif scene is a login screen. And it's just like, it's before I will take you to go meet the Oracle, you have to fight me. And that's your username and password to verify that you're allowed to, like, enter this little room that we're going to go to.
I like that take. That's a good take.
I think it totally holds up in the context of the movie. But that's why I wanted to talk to Ryan, because, like, I didn't know what a modal was. And I wanted to know, like, if there's a deeper layer to using modal here. And it feels like it's the modal is just really referring to, like Ryan says, the pop-up window that we see, the small Matrix code window on Thomas's screen. And otherwise, it may not have, like, any deeper, you know, philosophical or narrative underpinnings.
Yeah, the sense that I got was just that it's a word that we're using to describe, like, a piece of a video game in testing.
Yeah. We've gone through the narrative. We've gone through, like, what a modal is in terms of programming language broadly. But what is the purpose of this sequence? Like, why in the hell are we talking about this so much? And I think the sequence serves many, 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 many functions. One of the main functions of the modal opening prologue is it's a refresher for the audience, right? It shows you what we saw before. It gives you the same feel, the same sound, largely the same look of the Trinity sequence in the first movie. It grounds you in something very familiar, but we're seeing it from another point of view, right? Like, which is very, very important. Like Lana Wachowski is, she opens with this not shot for shot recreation of the original Matrix, but like it's a beat for beat following of that opening, at least for a little bit.
At least for a moment, yeah, until it's something, until they catch Trinity, and then it's something totally different.
And it gives you something very, very familiar, but then it's also, and I think this is important, that it's the last familiar vibes that we're going to get for basically the rest of the movie. Like for the whole rest of the movie, the Matrix and the world and the look and the feel of it and the aesthetic, which we'll get to later, like it's all very different. This is the only part of Resurrections that looks and kind of feels like the old movies, and then we discard that and we start doing something new.
Well, and it's said explicitly, right? It's said explicitly that this looks like old Matrix code, and why would you use old code? And then later on in the movie, we're told that, you know, this is a different Matrix than the one that we inhabited in the previous trilogy.
One of the other like big things that it does, I think I touched on this before, is that the modal prologue creates a sense of mystery and gives you a very exciting opening and puts up a bunch of questions that are going to be in the back of your mind while we're watching this like very dark and radically different, like tonally and emotionally, like sequence of Thomas kind of living his day to day life, unknowingly that he's in this new Matrix created by fucking NPH.
I mean, I know I said it before, but like you're very much just wrapped in this first 12 minutes trying to figure out what's going on, and you're given so few answers, and then you continue to get loaded up with questions kind of up until the point where Thomas is liberated.
Well, and the other thing with the modal is that like Bugs knows way more than we do throughout the whole sequence.
Yes.
She knows that she's not actually in the Matrix. She knows that this is some kind of weird recreation. She knows that everybody that we're looking at is a program, that it's some kind of recreation. And she knows who made it. You know, she knows so much more than we do at this point. It's just the same way as in the first movie.
She also knows that she's not allowed to be there, that the general forbids this, or the protocols forbid this.
Well, the general, the protocols forbid it, and that it might be a trap. You know, Seek, I think, is pretty savvy in saying, like, this might be a trap. Like, sure, maybe Thomas Anderson, maybe this Thomas Anderson that we're looking at really is Neo, and maybe he did make this, but also maybe it's a trap by the machines to lure us in here to do exactly, you know, that, to as bait. That's bait. The other thing that it does, and this is tying back to our previous episode where we talked so much about the recurring themes in the Wachowskis' body of work, the modal prologue, by showing us, even for a program with Morpheus 2, showing us his self-actualization and his liberation from the machines, is that it is a refresher for us of the most important thing about the Matrix, which is not bullet time and rad leather and cool sci-fi concepts. It's that you, and whether it's Neo or whether it's new Morpheus, that you are trapped in a prison of the mind. And the sequence is rooting you in what is most important, which is the liberation via self-actualization. This is the view from the valley floor, right? She's reminding us like, hey, maybe we forgot, you know, like we do a fast forward 12-minute version of it before we see it again from Thomas's point of view, where he has to self-actualize and free himself from the prison. But like, she's reminding us right up front, like, yes, it's about rad kung fu and slow-mo and bullet time and great sci-fi cyberpunk concepts, but it's also about liberation. And it's about self-actualization. And we have to get that right off the bat, because the whole movie is, I think a lot of it is about Lana Wachowski trying to reclaim the Matrix from, you know, the worst fucking people out there, essentially.
That reminder is, I think, massively important. Can I bring up a slightly non sequitur about this, the modal?
Yeah.
One of the things that really tickled me, and I'm not sure that I have an answer for why or if it's important, The one marquee on what I think is a restaurant that Bugs ends up sliding down.
Uh-huh. So you had to freeze frame this too to find it, right? To see what it actually said.
Of course I did.
It's so good.
It's so fucking good. It's Anderson's for those who love to eat shit.
Yeah. She's having a lot of fun. And it's also, it's Tom. It's Thomas having fun,
it's
right?
It's Tom. It's him rebelling against his prison.
Yeah, but he's also saying, like, Anderson's, I'm the guy who eats shit. Like, he knows. He knows in some subconscious way that he's repressing and he's blue-pilling away, that he's just eating a bowl full of shit every day. It's so good.
And it's so, like, loud and front and center. Except not, because it goes by so quickly. You're like, did I just see that? Did that just say, for those who love to eat shit? And then you rewind and you're like, nope, that's correct. That's what it said.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It's just so much fun. It's like, it's this joyful moment with inside of like this badass action scene where Bugs is showing off her moves and about to like encounter agents and escape them in one of the most badass ways possible.
Bugs just rules. I love her. I love the way she moves. I love the look. I love the voice and her lilt and the integrity of the performance. I don't know that we're going to talk too much about Bugs for the rest of the miniseries, but like maybe my favorite Bugs moment in the whole movie is when, so Thomas has been freed and he asks Sebebe and the other Cynthians, did you see who it was in that other pod that was in there with me? And he's like, I'm pretty sure it was Trinity. And Bugs is like, Neo, we just don't have a way to go back in there and get her. And then one of the other crew pipes up and is like, yet. We don't have a way to go in and free her yet. And Bugs, the captain, like, you know, Morpheus never really was questioned, right? Everybody followed him. And all the leadership, like, very rarely, like, tolerated questioning. And that's part of, like, the political subplot struggle in the second and third movie about whether we follow the path of Neo or we just use our military strength to try and defend Zion.
They even take extra time in Reloaded, like, in the very beginning of Reloaded, when we're introduced to what's new operator guy's name?
Oh God, why can't I think of the character's name? He's played by Harold Perrineau, who's a tremendous actor. Link.
Yeah. They take the time with Link and Morpheus. Like, after Link has questioned Morpheus, Morpheus is like, I need you to trust me. And it's like a, I don't know, 3 minutes of this like hip check of my authority needs to supersede everything.
Yeah, exactly. But then Bugs, she has this moment where she's questioned and they say, you know, we don't have a way to save Trinity yet. And she takes a beat and nods and looks Neo right in the eye and says, okay, we don't have a way to save her yet. Like that's another element of like that character that I think is like an avatar for like this generational difference of like looking at the next generation coming up and how they've lived in your shadow and how they're putting, you know, Neo necessarily on a pedestal as a deity or whatever. But like there's this willingness to change and change her perspective that I feel, not to give them too much credit or to paint with too broad of a brush, but like that I feel is just very much a part of this generation that's coming up right now. These Zoomers, these poor fuckers that are coming into a world that we've doomed.
Yes, I agree with that. I also find like we just talked about the differences between command style of Bugs and Morpheus, but the way Bugs moves through the world, she does have a Morpheus-like certainty. When she is taking action, her confidence is like oozing out of every pore. She knows what to do in that moment, in the same way that Morpheus does the entire time until his confidence is broken by Neo saying that it was all a system of control.
Yeah, and then Morpheus as a character basically recedes into the background and yeah, is a major problem for the third movie. I think.
I agree.
Yeah. You know what the primer of this, the reminder of the most important themes that I'm talking about, you know what it reminds me of is the scene in The Last Jedi, a movie that I swore we would never talk about on the podcast aside from our never to be released like beta test pilot.
That was a fun episode that we did.
I don't know that that's true, but
I had fun recording it.
I did too, but I was very drunk at the time. But I just don't want to talk about it because that movie is like the third rail of internet movie discourse. Like you talk about The Last Jedi and the worst.
It's good. We both think it's good.
Yeah, I know, but I just don't want to. I just don't want to engage with those people because they're out there. Okay. And anyway.
What's your parallel?
So you know the scene where it's Luke's lesson number one to Rey, right? He takes her out on the rock overlooking the ocean, and he has her close her eyes, and he explains to her what the Force is. And because she's saying it's a power that you have as a Jedi that enables you to move things with your mind. And Luke just like breaks all that down immediately. And he reminds her of the philosophical and the spiritual importance of the Force, right? It's not that you have like telekinetic powers. It's that you are connected to everything and everyone around you. It's about your feelings. It's about engaging with the world emotionally first instead of like kinetically or intellectually. That scene, like Rian Johnson has talked about it, that scene very much for him came from a place of like, I need to remind the audience what the Force is really about because, and he doesn't point any fingers, but if I were to put words in the man's mouth, which I definitely wouldn't want to do, but were I to infer meaning, I might say that that scene is necessary because not only the three prequels, which kind of reduced the Force from something that was spiritual into fucking like sci-fi gobbledygook with just midichlorians, and also not talking about like the emotional and spiritual connections of the Force, but like Rey's journey in The Force Awakens, like there's none of that. There's none of the spirituality of the Force. It's she gets telekinetic powers and she has visions and she can use a lightsaber. And, you know, Mr. J.J. Abrams, who loves fucking Star Wars so much, like didn't connect to it in a deeper substantive way. And Rian felt the need to remind audiences like, no, this is what we're actually talking about. This is why this is important and resonates with people. And I think Lana Wachowski is doing the same thing with this sequence here. It's like, no dinguses. It's not just the leather and the slow-mo and the kung fu. Like the reason that you liked this and why this story has resonated is because it's about real things. Like everybody can relate in some way to being trapped in some kind of circumstance, and that it's only the way that you think about things and that you engage with the world. Like that's got to be the first step before you can escape.
And as much as we love the leather and the badassery, we need to remember that it stems from these themes.
Because if that was the reason that those movies were so successful, then any of the, you know, couple dozen Matrix imitators that came out in the early aughts would have been just as successful and have stood the test of time with audiences, but none of them really did. They just stole the look of it and the feel of it, but didn't actually get to the meat.
And the meat's good. I like the meat.
It's good meat. So the last, and for me, just based on like my own personal taste and the stuff that I'm interested in, what I think is maybe the most important thing that the modal prologue is kind of setting up and beginning for the movie, it's the opening stanza of the movie's running meta commentary about itself and its own existence.
Okay, I'm going to need you to unpack that.
Sure. So I don't think it should be a surprise. I'm not revealing anything to anyone who has already watched this movie. This is a very blunt, direct movie that like specifically and explicitly asks, why does this exist? Why did we make it? And why are you watching it? Right? Like we get the recreation, yeah, the beat for beat recreation of the first few minutes of the 99 Matrix. And then we have Bugs, who is basically a fan, right? Like she's a fan avatar, which comes through very strongly in her big hug with Morpheus, but she's watching it. And it's like the Trinity scene is like canon for Bugs, right? She's like, we know what's going to happen next. She's going to kick their ass. And then Trinity proceeds to kick all those guys' ass. And then we have Seek there, but like, but why are we using old code to depict new events, right? Like this is the beginning of a running thread throughout the movie of just straight up asking us, why are we going back to the Matrix, right? Like, why is the audience watching this? Why did Thomas create the modal to recreate things that already happened? Why is Thomas's video game designer going back and making Matrix 4? Why are people so inspired and driven by Neo's story? Why is Thomas like obsessed with that past? And why are the machines so obsessed with mining the love and the past experiences of Neo and Trinity to build a new Matrix? Like, this is just the beginning. It's like that opening salvo, and it's very, very, very blunt and direct. And what I think it's most specifically addressing is like, and this could be me projecting because this is a huge like cultural beef of mine, but it's a movie that is directly engaging and questioning our nostalgia, our collective cultural nostalgia, and asking like, is this good? Is it harmless? I think it's bad is what I think personally. I don't know. Jamie, what is your relationship to nostalgia in general and like to your nostalgia?
It's complicated. Nostalgia feels good. You know, it's that South Park episode, the member berries. Mm. You know, it feels good to member.
Yeah.
Those things that make you feel warm.
Member Chewbacca, Jamie.
I member.
Member Cloud City. Member Neo fighting Smith.
You know, I rewatch A Muppet Christmas Carol every single Christmas. It's important to me. It's obviously entirely nostalgia. I don't usually get anything new out of it. It's just a reminder to me of where I came from and like good feelings associated with that time of year that can sometimes get drowned out. I have a tattoo of a character from that movie that's driven by nostalgia. I also have largely disengaged from a lot of the nostalgic media that surrounds us these days, because I'm pretty profoundly bored by a lot of it.
Why are you bored by it?
Because it's all the same. It's this like sameness that doesn't stimulate me in any way. You know, there's something about the same that can be comforting, right? It's, once again, why I watch once a year The Muppet Christmas Carol. But that's a once a year thing, as opposed to, let's say, a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. I don't know. How many releases of MCU movies happen every year?
I think for 2022, there will be 4 feature films and 3 or 4 Disney Plus miniseries.
That seems to me to be a lot of time to waste on retread ground and on not saying or doing anything new. I'll admit right now that, you know, some of my disengagement has led to ignorance of these products. Right? I disengaged a while ago and I haven't seen a lot of them, and I have been told that some of them are very, very much worth watching and do say and do new things. But I think that it's important for us to engage with new ideas and to push artistic styles and try new things, whether or not they're successful. 'Cause just redoing the old things that worked 10, 20, 30 years ago, is boring. It's not interesting to me.
Yeah. Well, it's what's the line? It's nothing comforts anxiety like a little nostalgia, right?
Right.
I can be empathetic to people who want to live in nostalgia and just want to keep going back to the well of Star Wars or of Jurassic Park or of Marvels or like any of the things from their childhood. Like I get it. And those things can be comforting, but I largely agree with you. I do want to push back a little bit though, because you're not just watching The Muppet Christmas Carol for nostalgia. Like, first of all, it's just a good movie. It is a good movie. It is yes. Well made. It's funny. The songs are great. Like you enjoy the experience of it. It's not just because it's transporting you back to your childhood, right?
That's correct. I enjoy the experience of it every time. It serves a specific purpose in my yearly cycle, but I also do, you know, I sing along with it. The Ghost of Christmas Presents song in the middle of it gets me teary-eyed every single time. That, like, it's emotionally resonant every year.
Yeah. So there is more to it than just nostalgia. And I personally, I think I share basically the feelings that you just expressed about nostalgia, which is like the 20 year nostalgia cycle is just like is choking the life out of a lot, not everything, but out of like a lot of popular culture and about a lot of things that are happening in the movies. We'll talk about this a little bit in our next episode. But like, I think the problem with the nostalgia cycle is that what they call the 20 year nostalgia cycle is built upon at this point nostalgia for a previous generation's nostalgia. In the 70s, George Lucas was nostalgic for his childhood cruising around the main drag of his hometown. And so in 1970, whatever, he makes American Graffiti, and then that becomes Happy Days. And then you have this 70s nostalgia for the 50s. And then by the 90s, we have a 90s nostalgia for the 70s. But then how else does George take his nostalgia? He takes his nostalgia for Flash Gordon, like, and the Republic serials of his youth that he saw on TV all the time, that themselves were like a generation before he was even alive to see those things theatrically. But he funneled that and he synthesized it and he created something new in Star Wars. But then You've got the 1990s nostalgia cycle looking back on Star Wars, and then Star Wars comes back in a huge way between a big VHS release in the mid 90s and all the toys coming back and the prequels. And now where are we? Where Star Wars came back again, but it's just nostalgia for more Star Wars. Like the nostalgia cycle for me is fucking eating its own tail, because we'll just never let any of these things die.
Star Wars is particularly fertile ground because it can be nostalgia for now 3 generations.
If not more, yeah.
I mean, I remember hearing my mother talk about how she saw Return of the Jedi in theaters and what her experience with it was like. Then, you know, I didn't have that experience. I watched the original trilogy on VHS for the first times. Then the special editions and the prequels happened, and that was my experience. That ultimately led me to disengage. But for those who didn't, it's several generations of nostalgia, which I guess is why it's so wildly successful.
I mean, there's a lot of why Star Wars is so wildly successful that we are absolutely not going to get into here. But I don't think it's just nostalgia, you know, like it was one generation's nostalgia, but then just like with the Matrix, like there's meaning and there's substance to it that is so broad and general that everybody can kind of apply it to their own lives and feel like it's resonant. And then on top of that, it's parents showing it to their kids and their kids' kids. And it's never going to go away. It's just never going to go away. So I feel like this, like in this movie, and now I'm going to put the point to you. What do you think Resurrections has to say, or specifically the modal? Like, what meaning do you draw from the modal prologue about nostalgia and about these recreations of things that are long dead?
Huh. Interesting question. I mean, maybe it's because I was just talking about finding new meaning and doing something new and interesting. But, you know, the modal sequence starts with Bugs as a fan watching a sequence that is iconic, right? We know what happens next. She kicks their ass and she's so excited for it. But then it quickly turns into her discovering Morpheus in this situation where Morpheus should not be. So it's about utilizing nostalgia to say or do something new.
I think Lana Wachowski is like, she's weaponizing nostalgia, you know, just as the movie will say that the Matrix will weaponize anything meaningful that we have against us. I think Lana is using everybody's nostalgia for those old movies to like smuggle in new ideas and to like threaten and attempt to destroy like the concept of this kind of slavish, superficial nostalgia that we seem to be trapped in. And I don't think it's Thomas having nostalgia. Like, he's not nostalgic for those old times, and that's why he made the modal. I don't really think that's the idea, but the modal is definitely a meta representation of our nostalgia for the old movies. But for Morpheus too, this nostalgia, this recreation of the Matrix is a prison. Like, it's just straight right up a prison for him. And it's like, going into the narrative elements of it, like Thomas is his slaver. You know, like Thomas is trying to do something to free himself, but is he really any different from the machines using him as a battery? He's using this program of Morpheus, this Morpheus Smith amalgam to liberate himself. He's exploiting him just as much. We'll talk about it again in the next one, because I have a lot more to say about the nostalgia. But I think the modal kind of sets the stage for all of the conversation that we're going to have about this like inquisitive, like inward looking conversation about why the hell do we want this? Why do we want more of the Matrix?
Yeah, I hadn't thought as much about Morpheus/Smith, that the modal was a prison for him.
It's a treadmill, which, right? He puts him on a treadmill and he's banging his head against the wall.
And he admonishes Thomas for it later in the movie.
Great scene.
Yeah, it's, you know, he created this thing very selfishly to wake himself up and then resists it.
Right. Yeah. Morpheus does exactly what Thomas created him for. And then he's like, no, 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 no. I am not ready for this right now.
And ends up right back with the analyst.
Well, we'll get to him. We'll get to him.
We sure will.
Yeah. we're foregoing our regular games for this miniseries as we're trying some new things and we're seeing if we can find new directions for the show. But my wife, Tani, in lieu of a wife takes, did provide a poetic prompt here that I think is for both of us. But Jamie, I'm going to put you on the spot here, okay?
Okay.
So in the context of the modal, but really just in the context of how her brain works, which is delightful and convoluted.
And weird.
Tani poses to us, complete the following poem. So I will read to you the lines that she has written, and then you have four options to complete the stanza. Are you ready?
Okay.
All right. So, with a movie and wine as a pair, discussing the aspects they share, is it iconoclastic or merely bombastic? A, wait, that's Jamie's ties that I paired. Or B, just remember, to share is to care. Or C, when Jamie and Scott are on air.
I'm going to go with C, when Jamie and Scott are on air.
All right. Well, her answer is C. She says that A, wait, that's Jamie's ties that I paired, is torturously worded and bad rhyming. So I'm glad she acknowledged it. B, just remember, to share is to care, uses internal rhymes of words that have been used before and is moreover facile and twee. And that C is thus the only plausible answer. So then her completed poem is, with a movie and wine as a pair, discussing the aspects they share, is it iconoclastic or merely bombastic when Jamie and Scott are on air?
An apt question.
I think we have a new show description for our show notes on all the podcatchers.
Oh man, that's a good one. I like that.
All right, Jamie, we've escaped the modal. We're liberated. We're free from the opening sequence of the movie. We have left the valley floor and we're in the hilltops. Where are we going next?
So next time on, we'll be discussing the 2019 Domaine Chauffite Pinot Gris tradition. This is available at b21.com. That's b-21.com for 26 United States dollars.
And will this give us a little preview? How is this going to compare to what we just drank today?
So we've examined Italy, and we're stepping from Pinot Grigio into Pinot Gris territory. And as I've mentioned, those are just synonyms, but they often on a wine label will denote, or rather connote, differing styles. We're gonna be dealing with more botrytis, more ripeness, and a little bit of residual sugar.
Well, I do love some residual sugar. I'm tired of these dry wines, Jamie. Give me some sugar. Give me some sweet.
You got a sweet tooth, Scotty. I know it.
I do. Why? Well, I like sweet. I like flavor. The dry and the astringent. It just feels like homework.
So what part of this M4Trix are we going to be taking on alongside Domaine Chauffite?
Well, next up, we're going to be talking about just the next 12 minutes of The Matrix Resurrections. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Do you know that there are whole podcasts that are dedicated to going through, like, week by week, each episode will be dedicated to 1 minute of a movie?
That is true insanity.
There's a bunch of them. The one that I always think of is called One Heat Minute, and they do Michael Mann's 1995, like, epic, you know, modern LA crime movie masterpiece, Heat, 1 minute at a time. And that is a 3 hour long movie.
What the fuck?
And I think by like episode, you know, whatever, 180 near the end, they achieved such a level of awareness that like Michael Mann actually reached out and ended up being on the show to discuss one of the final minutes of the movie.
That's actually pretty cool.
It's really cool. We're not doing that.
No, please God, no.
Although if Lana Wachowski wants to come on our show and talk about any 60 seconds or 12 minute period or whatever she wants about The Matrix, please, dear God, that would be amazing. I would love to pick her brain.
That would be really great. I'll pour a wine that you like, I promise. Come on our show.
No. So next time, we're going to look at The Matrix Resurrections in the context of lega sequels, which is a term coined by a film critic named Matt Singer in reference to this increasingly dominant trend in franchise filmmaking of like digging up a long dormant franchise or an IP and doing a sequel to it decades later that acknowledges the passage of time and somehow is like a passing of the torch from the original cast to the new cast. And I think this movie is both very much an example of one of those, and it is intentionally an example of one of them to interrogate again, like, why in the fuck do we keep doing this? Why do we keep going back to these things from 20 or 30 or 40 years ago? So I have a lot to say about it. I think it's going to be a great episode.
I think so too.
All right, Jamie, take us home.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. It was and always is a pleasure podcasting with y'all. Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us with any questions or comments at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. And make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. Also, tell a friend.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. Our social media presence is thanks to the fine work of Jamie Harrison Rubin. That is him, virtually across from me.
Remember, everyone, to drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
Goodbye, y'all.